Thanks, Ignacio, and thanks the organizers for inviting me. I will talk about some really not very recent, like some work in February. Since this is a topological workshop, I think I should talk about something related to topological. So this is a work that's related that relates quantum chaos and topological order. I forgot what exactly the title I gave. Quantum chaos and fractional statistics, maybe. Let me start from some discussion about quantum chaos, and we are going to talk about some four-point function measure. And probably you have heard some talks, like the talk of Steve Shanker yesterday about it, but just to be complete, in case you are not there, I will start discussing about quantum chaos. So classical chaos, has a picture like I have a phase space, and then you have some trajectory. And then chaos is measured by how you change this initial condition by a tiny amount, say P and Q, change it a little bit, then the trajectory can deviate, no crossing. The trajectory can deviate a lot. Okay, no. So in general, I mean, if you plot the distance, like you plot the deviation, then as a function of time, then it will grow. And then, of course, if your like if your phase space is confined, like your equal energy contour is some finite volume, then they cannot keep separating, right? They have to go up and down. So a measure of the chaos is you can take this displacement, epsilon, go to zero. And if you take that limit, then basically, okay, you have a coordinate, let me call PQ together, let me call it x. Then basically, you are taking the xt as a function of the initial condition, and you take derivative over as x0. So this derivative, and there's some components in general, this derivative tells you, like, if you do infinitesimal change here, how much change you get at later time. So that will behave like this. And then we know, for example, if you focus on the early time behavior, then this thing is a matrix that has some singular values that gives you Lyapunov exponents. So depending on what directions you choose in the phase space, this may grow or decay, and in an exponential way, and then the exponent is the Lyapunov exponents. And then, but this is only one kind of measure, and you can also have other measures of this kind of function. And you can talk about their long-time behavior, short-time behavior, and the generalization to quantum case is naturally you observe that this is actually a Poisson bracket. It's something so. In the quantum case, you observe that this is actually a Poisson bracket with this is like just the symplectic metric. So there's a Poisson bracket like that. So then the generalization to quantum case is, in general, you just take two operators. I'm writing now general operators and commutators. And if you go back to the classical limit, this should be positioned or momentum. But in general quantum system, we don't even know how to define them, or I mean, you can define them if you choose some like coherent state path integral. But in general, you don't need to worry about that. You just choose operators and study their commutators. But then you then what you care is, roughly speaking, whether this thing grows and how fast it grows, and that will correspond to the positive Lyapunov exponents. But generally, this is a this is an operator. So you have to measure its growth in some kind of norm of the operator. So for example, you can study a norm, which is like trace norm of this. And more generally, you can, instead of considering just the norm of the operator, you can consider evaluating this the size of this operator in a given ensemble states. Like, it makes more sense to restrict it to some energy window, right? Because I don't, maybe I don't care how fast this grows in a very high temperature, and I care about in a physical system with a given temperature or given energy how fast it grows. So you can generalize this to calculating it say for a thermal ensemble. So this is how you can go from the classical case to the quantum counterpart. And what you expect is if you choose these operators to if the operators are generic, then this thing will grow if there is a Lyapunov exponent. It will grow with the maximum Lyapunov exponent. And of course, in general, in quantum systems, if I just give you a quantum mechanical system, there is no reason that growth is exponential. In general, it may just be some other function. And so
exponential, is there any reason why there should be only one exponent?
In general, there are more. But because we don't have a way to get a spectrum, so I think it will be dominant by the biggest one. So it's certainly a very interesting question how we have a more refined description. Like, instead of just looking at the norm, is there a way to get the analog of like the spectrum of the Lyapunov exponents? And I don't know a way to do that. So just want to add the references. This work was like for the single particle case. This was discussed a long time ago. There was a work of Larkin and Ovchinnikov in 69, and then this quantity was discussed recently in holography and many body physics by Steve Shanker and Douglas Stanford, and also Becky Dive here, I think. Yeah. This quantity, roughly speaking, is measuring how big commutators of operators are. And if you think about, like, I have an operator, so this is time. Let's say I have a local system, something like a spin chain. So the intuitive picture is, let's compare what happened with a free fermion or free boson, free systems, and some more interacting and chaotic systems. So in a free system, what happens is if you have an operator at time zero, say you have a W act at time zero, and then you evolve the system, then the influence is basically a superposition of different, the particle goes to different positions. So it's a sum over some local operators. So when you measure the commutator with some other operator at time t, if that operator is also local, then you're basically picking up some signal that wherever the particle goes. Say if you have a light cone, then you usually pick up some commutator that's big here, and then it becomes smaller in the later time. On comparison, in the chaotic case, what happened is not like you don't just get a particle that's superposed between different parts, but your operator will evolve into some operator that occupies everywhere. There's a product of operators at different places. So generally, like your operator, say VT, if you expand it in the Schrodinger basis, this Heisenberg operator, if you expand it in this Schrodinger basis, you will get a sum over many terms, and generically the terms looks like a product of a string of operators. Like generically, it's not like an operator lives here or here, it's a string of operators. So that's why, like when you look at this commutator growth, in the ordinary non-chaotic system, in the free systems, you generically see some like growth because of the Lieber Robinson, because of the light speed of light or Lieber Robinson velocity, but then it generally goes back. Like if you look at the commutator as a function of time, and then in the chaotic case, what you see is a saturation of long time.
Yeah.
In the free case?
Yeah.
In the free case, if you choose two local operators, I think it will look like this generally.
For example, with the Ising model, something that looks very local on the free fermion basis can look very non-local on the spin basis.
Right.
And I'm wondering if there's some concrete statement you can make that these are the right operators to choose in our solution.
Yeah, I think here I won't consider Ising model as a free because as you said, you do have this. I mean, some operators, some local operator does become non-local. So I think then you can have a non-trivial commutator after some time. So the free case is like local operators remains local. It means like if I view it as a fermion problem, then some local operator will evolve only into something like this with a zero position. So it won't get string operators. I think that's related to what I'm going to talk about the rational CFTs, because these are like, I mean, they are not completely chaotic, but some CFTs has more non-local time evolutions than others, and that is what is probed by this long time behavior of the commutators. Yeah.
If the free case was in like a chaotic billiard or something, so it was closed, would it go back to zero?
You are talking about a single particle.
I assume that's what you mean by free, right?
If the space is finite size,
Yeah. Then
it will periodically come back, right? So it's, you have something coming back periodically.
Is that true in a free system which is single particle with a single particle chaos?
Yeah, that's right.
So that you have a billiard ball which has.
Well, then you may not have a periodic peaks, but you still have some peaks. I mean, you won't have any sense of saturation, like because you just your time evolution do not involve too many operators. Like the operator just becomes zero position of some n squared. Like if you have n possible lattice size, you involve your bilinear term will involve like only n squared operators and zero position of them. So you can't have a commutator that lasts very long.
Just to clarify, wouldn't the natural analogy time average would actually saturate to some non-zero values of the it would still be very peaky in a particular realization?
Maybe the time average, maybe I can use the time average to distinguish these cases, but I haven't thought about that. I'm not sure if, I mean, in this case, because this lasts a long time, so the time average will give me this value. But in that case, it will also give me some value. I don't know if maybe this is larger than that, but yeah.
Just because a billiard actually doesn't have a time average.
Well, but in this measure, a billiard, some single particle chaotic system, I think I want to say that's in this class. That's distinguished from the many body chaos. But in that sense, we are kind of like, I mean, this criteria, when we go from single particle to many body, we're not really completely measuring the same kind of the chaos defined in the same way, I think. I mean, because in the many-body case, there is a difference between local operators, which say if I have a spin system, it involves several spins, and non-local operators. So in single particle case, there is no such a difference. It's just operators that are position, momentum, and things like that. There is no sense that some of them are more local than others. But so in the many-body case, if I focus on the evolution of local operators probed by other local operators, then this measure is more sensitive to whether quantum information spread in the space, in the Hilbert space, from local quantities to non-local quantities. In single particle chaos, that doesn't happen. You have some information that's moving in space, but it doesn't become really non-local in the sense that you cannot measure it in any small region of the system. That's a new thing in the many-body case, I think. Yeah.
Sorry, technical question. Suppose I don't have the square. Suppose I just have commutator times rho beta. Then
that's a response theory.
Right. That is linear response.
Yeah.
And sometimes people say that that's not a good measure of chaos because there's cancellation somewhat because the square. Is that really understood? But I mean, it's not a. It's just not a word. But it appears that's always the case that we always cancel out an interesting part when you don't square it.
Well, you certainly don't see any exponential growth, I think.
That's different. But
you still see some. You may still see some consequence of chaos because due to summarization, the response dies out.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can still see some difference between free and chaos.
You still see difference between system with and without summarization, but
this is supposed to be all closed systems. We're not thinking about.
Isolated.
And chaos, these are all closed systems, isolated systems.
Right.
Where do you get rho beta?
Well, you can replace this by a macrocanonical ensemble, and that should be presumably the same. This is just a measure of generically for states around that energy. Like I have many states for states in this energy window, how the operators evolve in time for these states.
Okay. If I have an isolated system, why do I
have to think about a window? If you have a system with satisfying eigenstate summarization, you can pick any one of them and that give you the same result. At least for early time. I mean, maybe when this operator gets very complicated, then maybe I cannot say that. So at least for talking about the Yapunov, that's safe. But generally, I would think of this as just a measure. Like I want to know about something about the dynamics of the system rather than about the property of a particular state. That's why I average it over a different state. This is a little too hand-waving, so let's talk about more concrete things we want to do. Usually it's hard for, of course, because we are interested in chaos, so in a general interacting system, we don't really know how to calculate this thing, and there are special cases where this can be calculated, like in some chaotic, holographic theories and in SYK models. There are these examples, and then one kind of examples are conformal field theories. So I'm only going to talk about 1+1 conformal field theory. So of course for these cases it's much easier to calculate this quantity, and the general conformal field theory was studied by the paper of Roberts and Stanford, maybe 15. I'm going to talk about rational CFTs because we can get more explicit results there. In general, you have general you can use the techniques to calculate four-point function in CFTs, and then you do analytic continuation. And the difference between rational CFT and general CFT is in the original case, you have finite number of conformal blocks. But the techniques you use are similar. So let me just be concrete and talk about rational CFTs. And so what happened? So let's consider consider the operators just for simplicity. We consider the operators that are primaries. So I'm writing it this way because in the 2D case, I have left mover and right movers. So I just have some holomorphic and anti-holomorphic sectors, and I'm going to write this four-point function, say FAB. Oh, sorry, I should explain something there that I forgot. So when we started this commutator, we can expand the commutator and we get four terms. Just write it this way. So you have four terms, two of them look like this, and two of them look like that. And the difference is these terms are out of time ordered, like you have time goes from T0 and then T0. And then in these cases, because you have a trace, so roughly speaking, you have ordinary time order. You have 0, 0, and then TT. So you don't need to go to time T twice. So these are the out of time orders. Correlations. And then these are maybe in time order. So what happened in a system that will thermalize is this in time order correlations will basically factorize in long time. It becomes like W square V square. Because you have some Swinger-Kaldish contour. Like you start with some density matrix, rho beta, and then you have a V here, and then you have two W's, but the other way around. So you only need to go to time T once. So this thing, if all the two-point functions decay in time, then basically this thing will, to the leading order, factorize into a separate expectation value of this and that. And the connected part is some decaying function. And this one is very different because you start from your initial state, and then you have to have W here, and you have V in a later time, and you have to go back to W and go to V again. So that's the picture. I have a initial state rho beta, and I have to go back and forth. So basically, all the new contributions, okay, related to Tarun's question earlier, like if I don't have the square, I can study response functions. And the new thing that's in this commutator square that wasn't in the response functions is basically in this term. This is the term that's intrinsically different from calculating response functions, and that's why like this term can have an exponential growth. So the exponential growth contribution comes from this term. I mean, roughly speaking, we have a general reason that you can't have exponential growth in response theory. So the exponential growth all comes from this kind of higher order in response. So it comes from. I think my understanding is it's like a fluctuation of this response coefficient. Like if you look at commutator square, something that doesn't show up in the commutator expectation value but shows up in the square, which is large, which grows exponentially, that tells you like different initial states in this ensemble gives you a very different response. And that fluctuation is what it can grow in time.
You kind of imagine that for operator correlator as a response to some kind of external field, you can write it down as a response to it.
You mean I can consider the...
So the second term, in principle, I can imagine like writing down as a response function to some external field, which linearly couples to two operators.
But the two operators are at a different time. So you have a field that already knows what is this operator look like in the future time and couples to it. That's exactly what's different from ordinary response where you perturb at an earlier time and look at the response later. That was the thing I forgot to mention. And then here we will focus on basically this term, which is called the out of time order correlation function, so it's OTOC. So here in the CFT case, we will have a correlation function that factorizes into the left mover and right movers. So you have something like phi A X T phi B 0 0 T 0 times the anti-holomorphic part. So far everything is in real time. So the way we calculate this correlation function, because we want this time ordering to be off, to be not time ordered. So the way to calculate that is you first write the correlation function that's imaginary time and time ordered. That's what we know how to calculate, and then you do analytic continuation. So what you do is you add an imaginary part to this time. Let's say you add an imaginary part that grows this way, so then you keep this ordering. So if you want to calculate the other term, then you reverse the imaginary part. And then the real-time part do not change the imaginary time ordering, because you add the real-time in after you do the, after you calculate this and you do an analytic continuation. And then, now, there for the 1 plus 1 CFTs, so, I mean, in principle, you can just apply the formulas and you get some function of the aspect ratio. And then there's some nice picture that tells you that the analytic continuation takes you to the second sheet of a Riemann surface. But I'd like to describe that in a more intuitive way. So for CFTs in 1 plus 1, we know like the right movers moves to the right. So the phi A satisfies the function like this, like something, I don't know if that's right mover or left mover, but so you know, like you can shift time and shift space and then it's preserved. So, and then for the left movers, then the opposite is happening, okay. So what happened is I can actually, instead of analytic continuation of time from imaginary time to real time, I can just say that as a translation in X. So I can just say this is x minus t, and this is x minus t. And remember, for the other part, I should do the opposite. I should replace x with x plus t. So then I draw a picture. This is x. This is imaginary time. Yeah. So if you draw a picture, then before analytic continuation, you have four points here, which are like BA. And then when I introduce the real time, I'm say originally these two A's are at position X. This is X. And now you replace that by x minus t. So let's say I'm interested in long time, because if t is smaller than x, then these two things are still commuting. There is nothing happening. Right? So t is bigger than x, then what happens is these two points move to here. And this is for the left movers. And for the right movers, they move to a different direction. This is x, and they move to x plus t. So this is a little detailed, but you can see immediately that something is interesting and related to fractional statistics here. So basically, what happened is you are calculating a four-point function, but after I do this real-time evolution, then the left mover and right movers do not sit on the same point when you think of them as on this complex plane. Like when I translate the time translation to spatial translation, then the left movers, the holomorphic part is this correlation. And the anti-holomorphic part is that correlation.
But at the end of the day, do you get an exponential behavior, or do you get a power law?
I don't get an exponential, because we will mainly be interested in the long-time behavior, which distinguish free and chaotic. Uh-huh. In short time, I think generically, I think in general I get power law, right? Am I right?
Or for CFTs?
I get exponentials if you only look at like one sector, but in general CFTs, that's not the case. I mean, I get a sum.
Scale if you're going to get an exponential.
Well, there is a temperature. I mean, these calculations are in finite temperature. So this picture, you should think as a finite temperature. Yeah. So I think in general you do get a. I mean, I think what happened is you, in the early time, you get a sum over many, you have sum over different terms which grows exponentially. So I don't know in the end what function do you get. And the thing that's universal and related to fractional statistics is the long time behavior, which is what we will talk about.
Did what seems to me a slightly odd analytic continuation procedure where I make these guys the correct imaginary time ordering, so it's now kind of the normal right axis, so they kind of don't cross each other when I do this, what you're calling analytic continuation, which is moving, basically. Is there an intuition for why that allows my analytic continuation to be correct?
Why
this particular ordering that you've done actually allows me to do the analytic configuration and then take epsilon to zero in the end and still get the
there's no approximation here. So I chose the epsilon, and then I'm just saying that the adding a real time is the same as translation in X. So everything is exact. And then you take epsilon go to zero. If you take epsilon go to zero, what happens is these two points get close to each other, these two points get close to each other, and they are finite distance. So it seems nothing goes wrong.
But it seems to me I could equally well have done that argument with that second one. I have I epsilon, I can make 2 I epsilon, and what I have 2 epsilon, I can make I epsilon.
Yeah, that's true.
But I get the same answer.
No, you don't. That's the other function, which is in time ordered. So actually we want to compare the two. So if you say I'm interested in calculating this thing with these two extremes, then the way you do it is you just, I mean, this whole thing is like imaginary time ordered. So what you do is you just write the same function, but exchange the order of these two. X minus T, I now 2 epsilon, and phi B now 3 epsilon, and everything else is the same. Then, okay, that's the other function, which is in time ordered. So let's compare the two. Then this one will be basically, I exchanged the top two. So two B's are here, and the two A's go from here to here. And then in the end, you all take epsilon go to zero. But that, this is exactly the key thing, that these two do not give you the same result. And the other side doesn't you see the other side, the order is not too important, because they don't meet each other. So the quantity, so we are interested in the long time behavior, and the long time behavior, I mean, you can directly write down that behavior of f, but the ratio is what becomes universal. If you take this ratio, so maybe I will first talk about the long time behavior and then write the general time expression. So when you take this ratio and take t goes to infinity, what happened is that, okay, the ratio means, so this part is the same. When you take that limit, they are identical. Like when you take this epsilon goes to zero, these two are already canceled. Even before you take t goes to infinity, the anti-holomorphic part already canceled. And the holomorphic part is different, because in one case this operator goes below that operator, in the other case the operator goes above that operator. So the difference is basically the monodromy. You take an A operator going around the B by a full cycle. So in the end, actually what you get is this monodromy matrix. I will explain the notation later. So the monodromy matrix, in the language that we are familiar with in the anion gradings, is basically the S matrix of the anion, S matrix of these different sectors, and then times some quantum dimensions. Or I can write everything in S matrix, so it's like. So basically, this thing is measuring how in the anion language how the two anions grade with each other.
Is FAB always single value?
FAB?
Yeah.
As a function of x and t, it is. Yeah.
I guess, well, you know, if you have different operators, sometimes the correlation functions can be multiple. In a non-abelian case, right? You have a
yes,
multiple
yes.
matrix.
Yes, and that's exactly the reason why you get this difference. Mm-hmm. Because
so
when I move one,
matrix, you're comparing the values of the matrices. F A B.
I'm fixing A B, comparing the value of these two. So yeah, this I mean this the fact that the 4-point function of the chiral CFT is not single value. That's exactly the reason why you get a difference of these two. But the function itself, when you multiply the anti-holomorphic part, the function itself is single value. I mean, this one is a physical quantity. It's single valued. But it's just the two different time ordering translated into two ways the operators are ordered, and that's how you get a different result. I'm going to give a more intuitive explanation when we think of the relation to the 2D topological order. But maybe before that, I want to first write down an expression that's not only the long time behavior, but the more general. Because for the CFT case, we can calculate the the four-point function even at finite time. So at finite time, I mean, when we take epsilon goes to zero, you can still use OPE. So you can take a operator product expansion. You fuse these two and the other two, and then in rational CFT there is some finite number of conformal blocks in that fusion. That gives you an expression that the F is something like. Let me first write G. That's a simple one. G is basically just an ordinary four-point function, and when you write it in three-point functions, you get some like one over that x plus t to some powers. I'm sorry. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. So then you get some sum over conformal blocks. And this eta is the aspect this conformal invariant parameter, so something like, so think about these 4 points as these 4 points as z1, z2, z3, z4, and take their ratio. So then the f, the difference between f and g is you take basically you take one operator and go around the other and take it back to the same position. And that gives you the same factor here. And then this one of the F is transformed by a matrix, Mij.
One of the Fs is eta bar, I guess, right?
Yes, sorry. Okay, so say this one is the one that's transformed, and the anti-holomorphic one didn't transform. The anti-holomorphic one didn't get a non-trivial monodromy. So the other one just basically stayed the same. So this M, generally, the M matrix, well, we can define it in a pictorial way that. Well, actually, I mean, okay. So Mij is doing this braiding between A and B, so that Mij times J is equal to braiding A and B. That's basically what we want here. So this picture is basically saying the four-point function decomposes into the channels, and then the consequence of braiding these two, of exchanging these two by a 2π, is a basis change in this fusion channel. And that's what is the linear superposition of the blocks. So when you take this matrix, this matrix is also a, Mij. AB, yeah, it's also a function of AB. So basically, you can see like this is a, you can write this as a function of F and R matrices. So Mij AB, and then when we take the long time limit, what happened is this function is dominated by the thing that decays slowest, which comes from I equals to identity. So that's where the coefficient there was written as M11, like MAB11. So which is basically like take IJ both to be identity. Then in that case it becomes something that only a function of the S matrix of AB. So we can write it something like this. You have some basically grading of the A and Bs.
So for G and F, they need to be different. Do you necessarily have to have multiple conformal plots? Or
I,
different even in the abelian case?
It has a difference in the abelian case. But the difference between abelian and non-abelian is in the abelian case, this is a phase. The braiding just give you a phase. Yeah. So you see the difference, which is so in the abelian case, what happened is this four-point function starts from some value and actually rotates. So if you look at it, I mean, so in the long time value is different from the zero time value, but it just rotates by a phase. And only in the non-abelian case, the amplitude of the like the this ratio, if I plot its absolute value, then in the abelian case it will basically stay the same, and in non-abelian case it drops to some smaller value, and that smaller value is determined by this monodromy matrix, and that's actually saying that if you use primary operators to probe the system, you see some chaos, which means maybe chaos is not the right word. You see some non-local scrambling of quantum information in the non-abelian case, but not in the abelian case.
So if you change the primary field to the descendant field, but in the same conformal family, I think the result should not change.
Right, in the long time, because as long as we're interested in the long time behavior, with finite temperature, then it only matters what are the conformal blocks, which sector am I in? Yeah. So descendants and primaries in the same family will give me the same long time behavior. But I think actually yeah. So that you can look at this formula and see how this function approach the long time value.
And usually, I think the result only depends on the statistic. So,
yeah.
Primary field and the
data. Yeah, so certainly the long time value will be the same. And I think also, there is an exponential decay function where you approach the long time value. And that function is also the same because that's just determined by the diffusion channel. So, I think it's dominated by the lowest dimensional operator you get by fusion these two operators. So that I think will also be independent from changing the primary to descendants. So about the difference between abelian and non-abelian. So basically, maybe I should first talk about the relation to the 2D quantum, like the 2D topological order, because that will make the discussion about abelian and non-abelian more meaningful. So I mean, you already see this braiding naturally shows up in this picture, but a more physical way to see why it's related to really braidings of 2D anion, 2 plus 1D fractional states, is let's consider a 2 plus 1 like a topological order, and then this is two boundaries. So you have chiral CFTs living on a boundary. Let's say if I have some Laughlin state, I have some U1 level k on the edge. So then this is time. And then we can translate this. We can have a physical process that measures this correlation function. Because this correlation function, again, we can use this translation in time. So let's look at the chiral. Let's look at the chiral part. The right movers. So I want to have a correlation function like this, So now, instead of analytic continuation, we can draw it in a real-time way. So we want to calculate B here, and A somewhere, maybe here, A here, okay. And then B again, and then A again. But you can actually change this to a time-ordered correlation function by moving the B along the light cone, which doesn't change that operator. So I can move B here, and then I can the same way move A here. So in this way, like I'm calculating some four-point function that's time-ordered and in real time. Basically, it's like phi A of x plus some bigger constant. So it's like I can shift this by a constant and make the constant big enough so that the time order is this way. So now this is process that I'm creating some anion at the CFT, creating another anion, and then first remove the anion B and then remove anion A. So I can then, of course, there is a corresponding thing you do for the left movers, which is like you have to move them in the other direction. So when you think it this way, then when I introduce this CFT, when I think of this CFT as living on the boundary of a topological order system, then this process is basically like I create an anion B in the bulk and take them out at a certain point. The anions cross the boundary of the system at that time, which is here, and then take them back to the system at a later time. Take them back in and annihilate them somewhere here. Does this picture make sense? It's hard to draw. But so basically, like I have this boundary, and so I can take anions out, and that corresponds to applying these operators. And then you take them in later. So more precisely, it actually should be something like phi dagger. Like you take out a particle, and then you take it back in. And then we should do the same thing for A particle. And A particle comes in later than this. But during this process, A particle comes in later. And then they are taken out later. And because of this motion direction, if you do it carefully, you'll find that actually the world line of the A particle always have a linking with that of the B. And if you do it with the regular time ordering, you'll find that, so this is calculating F. If you are calculating the regular time ordering, a similar discussion tells you that they don't link. Like you can, maybe you first take in A, take in B, and then you take A and then take them back, and then take B back. So the picture is that you can think of this four-point function as you are creating pairs of particles in the bulk and then moving them across the boundary and cross it back again to close the loop. And then the difference between the out-of-time order and in-time order is these two quadriparticle loops, they linked in this out-of-time order case. So from this point of view, it's natural that it's exactly this anion braiding that contributes to this long-time behavior of this function. Okay, so is there any question?
So if I think about a generalized FAB to, say, four, like with four different primary insertions, the result would be probably the same, right? So it's just the middle two rating, the S matrix of the middle two operator. Is that right?
I think there is a...
Roughly, or it might depend on whether you have the first two confused into vacuum or something.
I mean, yeah, but basically, I mean, this discussion only applies to the case where these two, yeah, I mean, you can define that thing. We can define A, B, C, D, and then a gradient between them.
Yeah. It seems like it's always the full grade of B and C determining.
Yeah, and in general, it's like some A, B, C, D, and braiding of the two with fusion channels I, J, that kind of picture. But this thing doesn't show up in the commutator square.
No, yeah.
So okay, so going back to the point about abelian versus non-abelian. So we look at this long time ratio, which is a monogamy matrix. So that's the long time behavior of the ratio, FAB divided by CAB. So this ratio smaller than one tells me there is a missing part of the information in the local correlations. If something goes to something becomes non-local, and that's exactly what gives you what's given by the non-abelian statistics. So what happens basically is in this anion language, you braid, and after you braid, you start with a pair of particles that fuse into vacuum, and after you braid, you don't necessarily end up with vacuum. And for example, in the icing anion, if I use sigma particles, this is zero. I mean, the probability of fusing back to vacuum is zero, and that's the extreme case where like if I am calculating the four sigma correlation functions, then in this channel, I lost the 4-point function completely in long time. So in long time it decays to zero. Correspondingly, if the commutator will do this, and if you have a finite residue value, the commutator just goes to a smaller long time value. Okay, so you see this is a measure, and we studied some examples of like SUN level K theories, and then you can see how like when you have a lot of degree of freedom, and somehow the theory is more and more non-abelian, then you have more and more R's that are very small. So in some sense, that's a measure of some theories more chaotic than others.
Is there some sense that the vanishing of the four sigma correlator at long time, that it really goes to zero by some accident, if you want? Is there some sense you can say there's some sense of chaos in this correlator?
Well, I can say quantum information becomes non-local, so it becomes completely not detectable in this chapter, okay. Like by local like sigma bar kind of operators. Okay. And you can, because you have other sectors that are non-zero, so you can probe something in other sectors. So this is okay. This is some measure that some CFTs are more chaotic than others. But we would like to think of some measure that's independent from the choice of operators. And the natural thing to do is to think about random operators. So what if we go back to the non-chiral theory, and then we randomly choose an operator, so locally doing something random, and that generically will be a sum over different classes. Right? As we said earlier, it only matters what conformal blocks I'm in, what topological sector I'm in. So a random operator will generally look like something like phi a bar times some random coefficients. In general, it looks like that, and so we want to study some out-of-time order correlations of the random operators, which becomes a weighted sum, a probability sum of these R's. so that the final value for a random operator is basically RAB times the probability that the first sector is in A and the probability that the second sector is in B. So we want to use that as a measure. And then the question is whether, so this is like average R. Then the question is, what is the probability distribution we should use? I mean, in principle, you can choose a different thing. But the natural choice is, if we claim the operator is completely random, then you want the probability to be proportional to like the Hilbert space dimension of that sector. And this is, the Hilbert space dimension, of course, is infinite. But we know there is a sense that we know how to regularize it, which is basically like, it's like the character. Well, character is like trace of, something like trace of this in a given sector, right? And then if you take beta go to zero, then this is like dimension of Hilbert space, which diverges. But we can, we just need this this proportionality. Right? So we actually know the ratio of these characters. Is the ratio of these characters, which means a character that beta goes to zero in A and in B, and we know this ratio is like the is given by the quantum dimension. Oh, actually, it's squared because I have the anti-holomorphic sector. So this is the argument that tells us that we should choose PA equals to PA is proportional to the quantum dimension square. So if you choose this, then it's like, I mean, I think this is physically what will happen if you randomly do something in a region that's large, and then you see what's the probability I end up in the sector A. And then the probability should be like that. And you use that here, and that gives you a very universal result that R is 1 over D square, where D is the total quantum dimension. Oh, I didn't mention the definition of D, sorry. So the DAs are the quantum dimensions of every sector, and the D is just a sum over them. So little DA is like the effectively what's the dimension of every particle, and then capital D we know is the same quantity that shows up in the topological entropy. So this R is actually e to the minus 2 times topological entropy of the topological order.
So in the correlation function with the random coefficients lambda, or in the operator, the random operator lambda, we choose for lambda PA or PA squared divided by some normalization?
I think, yeah, you choose the lambda to be a random number such that lambda A squared is PA.
Okay, I think.
Very fundamental, which is why I assume that this RAB doesn't depend on the conformal block?
No, RAB depends on the conformal block, which is this grading matrix. But I average over them. So I get some number that's...
But you're saying it's one over D squared, so nowhere here did the M11.
After the sum over AB. No, so RAB is can define for two operators, one in A sector, one in B sector. And then I'm saying I randomly choose an operator that has some probability PA in sector A. Mm-hmm. Another operator with probability PB in sector B. So I'm weighted sum over RAB. Over AB.
If I look at this thing on the right hand side, 1 over capital B squared, that doesn't seem to in any way reference the...
That's true, because I summed over AB, so of course I get something that's independent from AB. I get something that's only property of the whole system. I mean, AB is like choice of operators. I have already summed over them. So I get some function that's only the function of the whole topological order or the whole CFT. It's not a function of a particular AB choice. And what it turns out to be is some simple function, which is quantum dimension. But this knows about the DAs, right? This is a sum over. But you see the difference is in the single, when you choose a particular sector, abelian case, you don't get a reductor. In abelian case, you just get a phase. So you don't really lose any information if you braid things. Because like the particles end up with vacuum, so you didn't lose anything. But in a non-beating case, you can you have a M wave, you have this which is generally smaller than one. So, but when you average, the difference disappears. The theory with the same quantum dimension has the same R. And that makes sense, because even in the abelian theory, if you have a non-trivial abelian theory with non-trivial braiding, then if you start with some state that's not in a given sector, but it's a superposition of different sectors, some operator, like some operator which is a superposition of the Laughlin one-third anion and Laughlin two-third, I mean, these kind of things will operator like that will generically scramble and become non-local, because the operators are not relatively local to each other. So if you use a general operator to probe the system, indeed, no matter whether it's abelian or non-abelian, you have some loss of information into the non-local operators, which is shown by this fact that this is generally smaller than one. So that's basically the end of what I want to talk about. So you see, I mean, these are, of course, not really chaotic systems. They are original CFTs. It actually are very non-chaotic, but this measure tells you some theories are more non-local than others, like in the sense of scrambling of quantum information from local operators to non-local operators, they are indeed, I mean, more chaotic than the free theory. So this is an example that these measures can be useful beyond ordinarily what we ordinarily think as chaotic theories. Okay, thanks.
Got some questions, but is there any more questions?
So do you think that a similar result would hold for non-conformal field theory that lives on the boundary of some 2 plus 1 D base? Maybe the statistical properties, the set of sectors, is more general than conformal field theory.
I see. Yeah. So you mean, like, for example, if I have a topological order with some gapped boundary, then the same thing will happen.
Or it could be gapless but not conformal. I mean, like, for example, the velocities don't all have to be different than
right.
The modes.
Yeah, I think I'm interested in long-time behavior, where all the dynamics. All the details of dynamics goes away, so it's not so important probably to be conformal. So if I start from the bulk, then I will get the same kind of physics in that case. And maybe that will happen in an earlier time if you have a gapped system. Maybe it immediately goes to that value. If you have 2 different points, then it happens later because it may take a very long time to propagate information.
Maybe a high-level question. Are you aware of any precise connection between local operators becoming non-local in your sense and mixing in the sense of the dynamics being like an approximate unitary design? Is that also another precise notion of mixing and how things become non-local? There must be a precise connection.
Yeah, there is some work by Benny Yoshida and Dan Roberts,
yeah.
Where they talks about the like if you have an ensemble of Hamiltonians,
mm-hmm.
then there is some criteria that unitary, let's say 2 design requires this ensemble average of this quantity, the things Steve talked about yesterday. Okay, when you average in that ensemble, it's the same as the Haar value. That will be a criteria of you have enough complexity, enough chaos to give you a design. But these things you can write as a sum over correlation functions.
Yeah, okay.
But the difference from here is this will become a sum over correlation functions which are not restricted to local.
Mm, okay.
So it will be like sum over all, some correlation functions of all operators. So they are sort of related, but somehow this is like a stronger condition.
Okay, so there are no questions for this one, Sean.